In 2015, the Fundão Dam in the state of Minas Gerais in Brazil collapsed. The dam was operated by Samarco, and Samarco is owned by two of the biggest mining companies in the world, BHP and Vale. According to that year's annual report, BHP declared profits of $8.056 billion. In that same year, the dam collapse killed Pamela Isabel's five-year-old daughter. It destroyed the family home of Monica dos Santos, and it polluted a river that Marcelo Santana and his community had fought hard to protect for over 500 years. For these mining companies, this is a story about numbers, big numbers. To give you an understanding of the type of money we're dealing with, let's set out some numbers of our own. BHP is the biggest mining company in the world and the largest company of any sector in Australia. But what exactly does that mean? It means that in October of 2023, the company had a net worth of £114 billion. Between 2001 and 2022, when BHP was listed on the London Stock Exchange, it was one of the wealthiest companies in England. And Vale, the co-owner of Samarco with BHP, is the largest iron ore producer in the world, mining the iron that gets converted into steel. Steel is found in your computer, your kitchen appliances. It's found in your car, bike, motorbike. It's in the nails and structures that hold together the very fabric of your home, your office, and your world. Vale is valued at £47 billion, making it the second largest company in Brazil. This amount of money is inconceivable to the people affected by the dam collapse. In the state of Minas Gerais, the average yearly salary is equivalent to £4,236. What this gaping disparity means is that mining companies have a lot of power and a lot of money to spend on lawyers. And that allows them the luxury of time. Some might say, time they can afford to waste. The victims, on the other hand, have none of that.
They just hope people get tired, they hope they get bored, they hope that they, you know, that ultimately they're just going to die and that maybe their heirs aren't going to pursue the claim in the same way. And so they just hope that we'll run out of money, the clients will get exhausted, and ultimately you come to the table for a settlement, which is actually, you know, much, much less than you would otherwise be entitled to in law.
That's Tom Goodhead. He's a barrister in England and the managing partner of the law firm Pogust Goodhead. At the start of 2023, Pogust Goodhead brought some new numbers to the table. The law firm is currently representing 700,000 people in the largest ever class action case to be presented before the British courts. And the bill BHP would have to pay if they were to lose this case? £36 billion. I'm Liz Bonin, and this is Dead River. Episode 4, The Case of 700,000.
I'm Tom Goodhead. I'm the managing partner of Pogust Goodhead.
As you might have guessed from his name, Tom is a founding partner of Pogust Goodhead. His office is currently based in a tall, glass-fronted building near Liverpool Street in the legal hub of London. From where he sits on the 11th floor, there are clear views of the River Thames as it snakes its way through some of London's most famous landmarks. But Tom's life started in a more humble place.
I grew up in Newport, which is a city in South Wales, quite sort of post-industrial, really. But I grew up on the last but one house next to Pontymister, which is the mouth of the Sahawi Valley. All my mother's family are from Tredegar, and we are just miners from my great-grandfather back.
Mining in South Wales dates back to the Industrial Revolution. Between 1760 and 1914, iron and coal mining were the two largest industries in the country. Before coal mining, Welsh people relied mainly on agriculture to make a living. But coal brought new wealth and development to the country. And to keep up with the rising global demand for fuel, more and more mines were opened. The history of coal mining in Wales is largely one of economic growth and expansion, but there is a dark side to this era of mass production.
A generation perished in Aberfan. In a few minutes, nearly 200 children, happy because they would begin a holiday that afternoon, were engulfed. And for them, there was no holiday, no half term. It was to be their final term.
I think a lot of people will be familiar with the Aberfan disaster. That was something that, you know, we grew up with. My parents were both teachers. And, you know, it's just sort of one of those things that was talked about when you were growing up. People, sort of my mother's generation was sort of where they were when Aberfan happened. And it's not just Aberfan either. You know, it's you're dealing with a legacy of coal mining and what I would call sort of the post-industrial type society and all of the public health effects that come with that as well. So I used to do a lot of work involving asbestos and different types of industrial diseases that were associated with, you know, either mining or with other sort of heavy industries, and that is South Wales, really.
At the start of his career, Tom worked on small cases, working closely with claimants on personal injury claims or medical malpractice.
I loved acting for victims, and I sort of enjoy going up against the man a little bit. I'm quite sort of anti-establishment in certain ways. And so I very much enjoyed that, and I just fell into doing that type of work. And so I think I could probably count on one hand the number of times that I've ever acted for a defendant, a couple of things I used to do for the NHS, but 99.9% of my career has been spent on behalf of victims and claimants, and that's always the way I wanted it. As soon as I got into that work, I never really wanted to do anything else.
When you picture a typical lawyer, you might think of a serious, hard-to-read man or woman in a smart suit. But Tom is somewhat different.
So, yes. When you first met Tom in person, what was your impression of him? What would you say? Explain him to other people.
That's the voice of our producer, Palama.
There's no way to explain Tom to other people. You have to meet him to know him.
That's Harris Pogust. He's also a founding partner of Pogust Goodhead.
He's one of a kind. He has more energy than any human I've ever met in my life. He's too nice. So one of my jobs is, you know, I want to protect him from the people out there who try to take advantage of his niceness.
When Harris speaks about Tom, he describes him as a lawyer for the people. Tom dresses casually for the office. He exudes warmth, even when speaking with intention, and he's renowned for this infectious, booming laugh. This is the man who got off a plane in Rio for the very first time in 2017, entirely unaware that his life was about to change forever. In Rio, Tom had arranged to meet a lawyer called Leonardo. They were both members of the Global Justice Network. It might sound a bit like a League of Superheroes, but Tom explained to us that its main function is to allow lawyers to refer cases to other lawyers from one jurisdiction to another. So, for example, from Brazil to the UK.
So I went to Brazil to go and meet Leonardo and chat with him. And he represented, I think, about 6,000 fishermen in the Mariana case, and he wasn't getting any form of, he'd put in for sort of this compensation scheme that they had there for the fishermen, and he wasn't receiving any payments, and the fishermen were receiving any payments.
Leonardo asked Tom if he thought they could bring the case to the courts in the UK.
And yeah, I advised yes, it would be. We thought it was possible in law, and then after I advised positively, sort of said, well, what's next, really?
So if we're keeping track of numbers, we have two barristers, one working in Brazil and another working in England, and almost 6,000 fishermen impacted by the dam collapse. They had the beginnings of a case forming, but the thing about legal cases is that they cost money. And at the time, neither Tom nor Leonardo had much of it. That is, until Tom met Harris Pogost. Tom first met Harris in Hawaii at a Super Bowl party. They were both attending the same lawyers' conference that week, and for the next 7 days, they built a relationship. Through Harris, Tom met two other American lawyers who were interested in the work he was doing. The problem was these new potential investors were especially interested in the financial viability of a case Tom was creating against Volkswagen, and not so much in the Brazil case. But a couple of months later, after countless calls and lengthy conversations at all times of the day and night, they struck a deal.
And so they effectively said, look, you know, actually, we'll back you. They're like, there's nobody else who could, we think, could realistically do this. You know the case. They were more interested, actually, in the other case I was doing here in England at the time, which was the Volkswagen emissions litigation. And everybody remembers sort of dirty diesels and Dieselgate and things like that. And I said, look, okay, well, my side of the deal is, all right, I want to do Brazil. And so if you're going to, if you want to make money off Volkswagen, you need to fund me to do the Brazil case. And they were fine with that.
I think I invested in Tom and I as a team because we have different strengths. There are certain things we both do well together. And Tom's just a brilliant, brilliant guy. I mean, one of the smartest guys I've ever met. So, and I know how to run a law firm. I've been doing it for a long time, and I know the ins and outs. I know how to settle large cases.
We started an office in Liverpool in July 2018, and I then went to Brazil for the third time.
With Harris and two others attached, the case now had funding, but it also needed more people. So in August of 2018, Tom went back to Brazil in search of lawyers. And somewhat unexpectedly, he found Felipe Jota.
My first contact with the case itself was when Tom Goodhead, he actually came to my house for dinner and he wanted to get advice from my mother, who's also a lawyer with a lot of experience, and she is not fluent in English. So Tom actually was asking me the questions, and like, he was quite impressive by how I knew the law, the Brazilian law, and how I could help him in the environmental side of the case as well. So after his visit to my house, I was hired. So, and I was like the first Brazilian lawyer in the firm. It was very challenging in the beginning.
What sort of challenges were there?
Well, coming in Brazil on like in the countryside of Minas Gerais and Espírito Santo, people, they don't know us, and it's difficult to start a relationship with people just coming in and say like, oh, we want to represent you. It's not that simple, right?
It's important to remember the context of the situation that Tom and Felipe were getting themselves into. In 2018, it had already been 3 years since the collapse of the dam, and people were growing tired of waiting for justice. At the time, there were still 19 charges of homicide hanging over the heads of CEOs, employees, and board members of BHP, Vale, and Samarco. And on the ground, Renova had begun their restoration work, but tensions were high, with many victims feeling like they weren't being listened to or compensated fairly.
A Fundação Renova, ela vem fazendo uma propaganda.
Well, the companies, they set up this Renova Foundation in order to compensate us, and they have been very fast in publicizing and communicating via campaigns that they are doing the very best they can. And not only that, they say that they are giving us even better environments than we used to have. And they tell the public in these marketing campaigns that they are consulting us. You know, they are consulting us, but nothing that we're asking for is being done.
That's Monica dos Santos. She was a resident of the destroyed town of Bento Rodrigues. By 2018, she had become accustomed to these mining companies sending people in and out of her life. She had gotten used to people promising things they just didn't deliver.
Falta a restituição dos nossos modos de vida.
They have consulted us and consulted us, but they haven't implemented what we have requested. I know how I used to live, and I know what I need in order to live a proper life. And all the requests we make are not being met. So yes, we are being offered houses, but they don't meet our basic needs. They don't have gardens like we used to have, where we can plant food. And what about our animals that were displaced? Where should they live? How can they live?
This was the environment that Tom and his newly formed group of lawyers were entering into. Victims felt let down by the companies and by the Brazilian justice system. It's an environment that journalist Cristina Serra describes as lonely.
I got a sense that they feel very lonely fighting for justice. They feel abandoned by public power. They have many questions and many issues about our judicial system. They don't believe in justice in Brazil. The sense that I got is that they are very tired.
On that third trip to Brazil in 2018, Tom got to see how the victims had been abandoned firsthand.
I saw Beto Rodriguez for the first time, which was astonishing. I mean, I always describe to people now, it's just that, you know, it's just destruction. It's sort of almost post-apocalyptic when you see the sight there and what has happened. I mean, the situation was just insane. That this was close to 3 years post the disaster. And BHP and Vale, Samarco and this Renova Foundation, they'd actually done nothing. I mean, they paid peanuts in terms of financial compensation. Any supposed environmental remediation programs were bogged down in bureaucracy, or they weren't happening at all. There were numerous failures to comply with promises that had been made. I can't say I ever met anyone during that period of time who said, yes, I'm satisfied with what the Renova Foundation has offered me. Well, yes, thank you to the companies for acting, you know, as good corporate citizens after the collapse of the dam. It was just universal, absolute skepticism, pessimism, disappointment, anger. And yeah, as soon as we said, well, look, actually, the reason we're here is because we want to bring a lawsuit in England, we set up what we called these walk-in centres, which would sort of be in things like informal structures in community centres, or sometimes in like municipal car parks, in churches, different things, to have people to fill out the forms effectively. We had lines thousands deep.
When Leonardo first approached Tom, he was representing 6,000 fishermen. When Tom met Felipe in 2018, they thought perhaps 2,000 people might be interested in signing on to the case in England. By the time Pogus Goodhead filed their suit against BHP in November of 2018, they were representing over 200,000 people. You might be asking yourself why this case can even be tried in England. The Fundão Dam was built by Samarco, a Brazilian company. It collapsed in Minas Gerais, a Brazilian state, and it killed 19 people who were all residents of Brazil. So why would an English court and judge be able to rule on it?
BHP is an Anglo-Australian company, which means, you know, they're headquartered in London and in Melbourne. A British company, an Anglo-Australian company, has come to Brazil. They've made billions and billions of dollars of profits, and then they've committed what is the largest environmental disaster in Brazilian history. We're one of the most sort of, if anything was to meet a definition of ecocide, what they've done is literally ecocidal. And I would say, look, it's time to go after them, to go and obtain justice, whatever that means, at home. So I was like, if you had a problem with your neighbour's child, you'd probably go knock on your neighbour's door. I was saying, well, this means take it to London. I'd take it to England or Liverpool, as it was back then, in court. I think, you know, go there, basically.
The neighbour's child in this story is BHP Brazil. In 2015, BHP Brazil was a subsidiary of BHP, whose headquarters were in London. The parent company, if you will. Understanding how and why jurisdiction is assigned can be a bit complicated. But by explaining exactly what Pogus Goodhead is charging BHP UK with, this parent-child analogy makes a lot of sense.
My name is Caroline Narvaez Leite. I am a legal director here at Pogus Goodhead.
Carol had been working in litigation in Brazil for over 10 years, but a year ago she moved to London to join Pogus Goodhead's case against BHP.
I moved to London and I was very interested in what PG was doing, and I was completely in love with the case because it speaks a great deal to my heart because I'm Brazilian and I have seen what happened in Minas Gerais and the tragedy that it was, so it made complete sense to work with this.
As if this wasn't complicated enough, although the BHP case is being tried in English courts, the law that's applied to the case is Brazilian law. Because of this, the team of lawyers is made up of people who have an in-depth understanding of that law. People like Carol.
The main charge against BHP, or the fact that we are suing BHP UK and Australia here in the UK, is that they are an indirect polluter under Brazilian law definition of that concept. Indirect polluter principle, it's a principle that is a part of Brazilian legal framework that holds individuals or entities accountable for environmental harm, even if they did not directly cause that harm. The environmental law in Brazil decided to characterize polluter as someone who direct or indirectly have caused pollution, regardless of their direct activity. The one who is an indirect polluter is the one who owns a company, is the one who controls a company, meaning is the one that has the power to make decisions, to control the actions of the company who caused the environmental harm. By reason of failure to supervise the activity, which gives rise to a damage. By reason of funding the activities of others, which led to the damage. So when a company has financially contributed to an activity that caused environmental harm. Or by reason of benefiting from the activity of others, which led to the damage. So Samarco was the one that directly caused the harm all over Brazil. And you have as indirect polluter, i.e. the person who did not, with their own hands, with their own actions, cause the pollution, BHP and Vale. They are the indirect polluters in this case.
The standard defense that these big companies run is, well, it happened in Brazil or it happened in Nigeria or it happened in Zambia and we didn't know anything about it. The irony of the Mariana case is that actually BHP, in some ways, careful how I phrase this, but were doing the right thing in the sense that they were involved in the operations of Samarco. They didn't just leave it to local management. They did actually seek to adhere to sort of corporate-wide safety standards. They were receiving regular reports. They were sending their own people there. But then what happened was they were warned about the risks of the collapse and made very conscious decisions, or at least they endorsed very conscious decisions and participated in decisions that prioritized profit over safety.
In 2018, Pogus Goodhead had put together their case against BHP UK as an indirect polluter, and they were ready to fight on behalf of their clients in Brazil. But first, the case had to be approved.
It was filed in Liverpool, you know, right in the summer, just after the first lockdown in July 2020. And we very much wanted it in person, as did the judge. The only courtroom that was big enough outside of London to have the hearing was in Manchester. And Mr. Justice Turner, who was the judge in the case, who I think he was sitting in Manchester anyway. So, it happened over 8 days in Manchester. It was an absolute disaster.
Ultimately, this resulted in the judge not being convinced there was a case.
He was very sceptical about whether or not the English courts could manage this type of litigation, whether it was too big. And you could just sense that he... he thought, why are these people here? Like, why is this in Manchester? Why is it Liverpool? Why is this not going on in Brazil?
On the 9th of November 2020, Justice Turner handed down his verdict. He denied access to justice in British courts on the basis of, quote, abuse of process. He said that if the litigation in England was allowed to proceed, it would result in, quote, closely related group claims moving forward in parallel in two different jurisdictions. Put plainly, Justice Turner felt that because this happened in Brazil, Brazil should deal with it. But at this point, it had been 5 years since the collapse, and the victims felt it was not being dealt with. Ana Paula, who lost her husband in the dam collapse, found it hard to hold on to any hope that something would come out of the legal proceedings in Brazil.
Porque justiça aqui nesse Brasil são pra poucos, né?
I think the likelihood that justice will be served in Brazil is low, because justice here in Brazil is only for the few. Here in Brazil, for years, nothing has come of this, and I don't think it will. I can't fight these companies here. Nothing is going to come of it, and it's going to wear me out.
Tom knew only too well that this is what people were up against in Brazil.
What was frustrating was we put together extraordinarily moving and coherent evidence, witness statements, expert reports from victims, from mayors, from fisher folk, from sand miners, from the former prosecutor general of Brazil, from the former attorney general of the state of Sao Paulo, in fact, from two prosecutor generals of Brazil, that substantive access to justice wasn't available in this particular case in Brazil. And basically, the judge, I mean, frankly, I'll say, I just don't think he really read most of the evidence, because bluntly, I just don't think you can read all of that material and not come to a conclusion that something was obviously wrong with what had been happening in Brazil.
He still believed the process in England could offer something new, so he refused to give up. Pogust Goodhead appealed the decision.
They always say if you're going to lose really well, right? Like have a total loss. It's better to lose 7-0 than it is to sort of have a narrow 1-0 loss, because it actually makes it easier to appeal. And if you've had a judge at first instance who has made obvious errors, like not actually considering the evidence properly or applying the law wrongly or inventing a new doctrine that apparently a case can't be heard in the English courts because it's too difficult to manage, then actually that makes you really well set for the appeal.
In 2021, Pogust Goodhead sent in their request to appeal Justice Turner's decision.
We thought we had a great chance of appealing, and so we appealed. And then, unfortunately, we got a refusal of the permission to appeal from a judge who, I forget the phraseology he used, he said words to the effect that the first instance judgment was a work of art, sort of something of perfection. And I remember getting that through on email. And I was just, what the fuck? Like, I mean, it was just mental, completely mental. And that was that's the lowest moment for me of the case, was getting that. That was sometime in early 2021, I think, that came through. I just felt sick to the stomach. I really thought that was sort of a knockout blow at that point. And so, yeah, we had £16 million that was owed to Sort of May. And so when we got that through, you know, the immediate thing that comes to your mind is, well, it's the end of the case.
At this point, Pogust Goodhead had signed up over 200,000 people to this legal case. It had been 6 years since the collapse of the dam, and the case in Brazil was moving at a snail's pace, with all criminal charges of homicide dropped. Ana Salomão is the chief financial officer at Pogust Goodhead. She had been working hard to find third-party funding to cover the legal costs. She remembers the night that email came through.
It was a very sad call. It was in the middle of a pandemic. We were not together. We were all joining this online. And I remember how frustrated and how sad everybody was, people crying on the call. And was heartbreaking, and people having to figure out how are we going to tell this to our co-counsel in Brazil and how they are going to pass this news to their clients that it's over without actually having the opportunity to fight for it as we were imagining. The day after, around like 7 a.m., I was starting to receive invites for meetings, discussions, and calls of alternative strategies to keep fighting for the case. We never accepted to let it go because we saw that there was something there that deserved to be further considered. And then we had to seek funding not only to cover the adverse costs, but to keep funding the case. So we had to convince barristers, investors, experts, and all of that, that the case was still alive. I remember that people's reactions were various, but I think that 100% was like, okay, you are crazy. Let's do it together.
So, I mean, I sort of took a day to sort of think about it, but immediately started Googling, how do you appeal a refusal of a permission to appeal? And I found something called 5230.
This is the official definition of Civil Procedural Rule 52.30 from the Ministry of Justice.
The Court of Appeal or the High Court will not reopen a final determination of any appeal unless A. it is necessary to do so in order to avoid real injustice. B. the circumstances are exceptional and make it appropriate to reopen the appeal. And C. there is no alternative effective remedy.
I think the best analogy is basically where there's been a miscarriage of justice, like where there has been a fundamental, and the test is extraordinarily high for it. It's not good enough to show that they were wrong. You can't just have another bite at the cherry, effectively. You have to show that there has been a fundamental failure. The barrister's team were very reluctant to take a 5230 forward, as were a couple of my colleagues. I started looking at it and I thought, you know what, I actually read the authorities, the judgments that have been on this, and I thought it wasn't hopeless. I can't say it was that we were going to win, but I thought it wasn't hopeless because I looked at it as, I mean, something has got to be done here. It's just absurd. There is no such thing as a case which is irredeemably unmanageable. That was just fundamentally wrong. And so I sort of took that point. I was like, we've got to do something on this. I said, it cannot be right that the English courts have said that a case is too complicated here in England. And I was very determined not to let BHP get away with it. And so I remember speaking, I did sort of a town hall internally in my firm and then speaking to a lot of the lawyers that we work with. I was like, let's just crack on.
Pogus Goodhead filed their application for 52.30, and in the summer of 2021, they received a response confirming that a court date had been set to hear their case in the Court of Appeal. Their case would be heard by a panel of three judges.
We went back to court and we had a panel, and they said at the beginning of the hearing, and before anybody even started, they said, look, if we had been the panel, we would have granted permission to appeal. And they then said, so please, counsel, proceed on the basis of, you don't need to persuade us that an appeal should have been granted, but you need to persuade us as to why we should exercise basically this extraordinary power. And it was one of those times where your faith in the English legal system is really restored, because you thought, oh God, these are impressive people. And we won and got the 5230 granted. And so from that point on, I was saying to people, look, we're back in the game.
In the autumn of 2021, the application for 52.30 was granted. But this didn't mean the case could go ahead. It only meant that the law firm could now appeal the first decision made by Justice Turner. Nevertheless, Tom felt optimistic and energized to share the news in Brazil. He sent lawyers and coordinators to the impacted areas of Minas Gerais to recruit more interest for the case.
Fast forward then to July 2022, which is when we have the appeal hearing, 5 days long in the Court of Appeal. And I mean, what's awful is this is nearly 4 years after I start the case, and we're still fighting over jurisdiction. We had 5 days of what I would just describe as one-way hearing. I don't think that any of the three judges made a single negative comment or challenge to our barrister. And they saw, I think, what BHP had done and what they'd said. And they just forensically pulled apart the judgment from 2020. They pulled apart the arguments that BHP were making at the hearing. And then they produced extraordinarily lengthy judgment after 5 days, which basically said that we were absolutely right on what we'd said. And, you know, we got 15 grounds of appeal. We won on all 15 of them. They did the job that the judge should have done first time around. They actually read the evidence and they compared, you know, our evidence to BHP's evidence. And they generally found that what our witnesses had said, what our expert witnesses had said, was credible. That, you know, it's simply what BHP had said about the Hanover Foundation. They couldn't take it at face value. And it was sort of a weight lifted off my shoulders and others. We were like, we weren't crazy all along. You know, what I'd actually first advised back in 2017, I wasn't wrong. That actually, legally, we were right.
The court date was set for the trial to be held in April of 2024. When the trial date was granted, Anna Salomao accompanied a group of lawyers to deliver the news in person to those clients who lived in more remote locations.
I went to the indigenous community of Krenax because we wanted them to be the first to know. And it was so touching. After all the struggle and difficulty, to finally have a decision saying a court will hear what you're saying. What you're saying is relevant for someone. Three judges in England decided that you have a story and they will hear that. The chief of the indigenous tribe of Krenax, she was there, and I started asking her how she felt about the case. And she started to say, like, look, I'm happy that we have this opportunity, but at the same time, what if again it's another loss? Or what if again we have to deal with another frustration? And she started to explain to me how important the river is on their lives. And I told her, well, I have something to tell you. We won the appeal and the case is now continuing. She cried. I'm always emotional when I think about this moment. She started to blessing us on their language and crying of happiness and sharing with us the importance of the river on their lives. The river for the Krenax is a god, and it has such a significance in someone's life to lose a god. For me, what is magnificent of my work is that I can use finance to provide access to justice for people that otherwise wouldn't have means to access this.
The trial date was set to April of 2024, but in the spring of 2023, BHP requested an extension on the case. Amongst other things, the company wanted the time to add Valet as a co-defendant, so that should they be found liable, the damage payout would be split between the two companies equally. The extension was granted, but not by as much time as they'd asked for. At the time of this podcast release, the trial date is now set for October 2024. And as it stands, should BHP lose, they will split the damages with Valet. We asked BHP for comment, and at the date of release, they have not responded.
These cases can go one of two ways. We've got a trial in October next year. 99% of these cases don't go to trial. And this is a blockbuster trial. This is one of the largest cases of all time, and by many metrics that will inevitably attract huge amounts of media attention in England and in Australia and in Brazil. Any rational actor generally as a company will find a way to avoid that, and they won't go to trial on it. But nothing in this case thus far has been predictable, right? I didn't think we would lose at first instance. I didn't think that when we did lose, we would get a second judge who said that the first judge's reasoning was impeccable. I thought there would only be 2,000 clients, not 200,000, and now we're on 700,000. Like, nothing thus far has gone the way that reason or logic would dictate that it would follow. So my kind of working assumption at the moment is that we're probably going to go to trial. And then after that, even if you win, that's only the beginning, because all you do then is you prove that they are liable. At the moment, despite the fact the dam collapsed and despite the fact it's bleeding obvious to anybody who looks at this, any judge sat down and looked at the papers on this law, they would know in a day that BHP are liable. But it's highly paid lawyers that, you know, if you tell a lawyer to defend that the earth is flat, they'll find a way of defending that the earth is flat, and they'll charge you £1,000 for doing it, right? And so they could conceivably give us another 5 years of this after a judgment that finds them liable. They then get to argue, well, was it the collapse of the dam that caused, you know, this farmer to lose his livelihood? Or was it the fact that this farmer just wasn't a very good farmer and, you know, his business practices weren't great? They just hope people get tired. They hope they get bored. They hope that they, you know, that ultimately they're just going to die and that maybe their heirs aren't going to pursue the claim in the same way. They just hope that we'll run out of money, the clients will get exhausted, and ultimately you come to the table for a settlement, which is actually, you know, much, much less than you would otherwise be entitled to in law. And that is an approach that they could take. But we are doing everything in our power to go against them on that. We'll say, okay, well, if that's the approach you're going to take, we're going to name you, our clients are going to shame you. They will be loud and proud about and telling people about what you've done. And actually, you've kind of picked on the wrong people now, because this isn't sort of what we were, a tiny law firm in Liverpool 5 years ago. We're actually one of the largest law firms doing this type of work in the world now, with some of the most sophisticated lawyers, and we've learned a hell of a lot. And actually, our clients, they've waited nearly 8 years now, so a lot of them could wait another 5 years. They don't want to. And so it's almost like, who's going to blink first, effectively, to resolve things? And so I say, look, we're going to prepare for a settlement. We hope we'll get a settlement, but we're going to be ready to litigate it and fight it if we have to.
Tom had originally envisioned representing 2,000 people in this case. By the end of 2023, Pogus Goodhead had signed up over 700,000 clients. It's the largest civil claim to be brought before the courts of England and Wales, and one of the largest class action suits in legal history. Pogus Goodhead estimate the current compensation owed by BHP to be nearly £36 billion. In October 2024, the victims may finally have their day in court.
What I think is that the result of this case in England will force, let's say, somehow the companies and the public agencies here in Brazil, in a federal level, in a state level, to have fears that somehow the army of the justice will find them.
Cristina Serra is a Brazilian journalist. She first reported on the Mariana Dam collapse when she was working for Globo, a private Brazilian news channel. Her journalistic opinions are the result of the 8 years of reporting that she's done on this disaster.
They will know that even outside Brazil, the army of the justice can reach them. The possible impact here in Brazil is that maybe companies will be more aware of their responsibilities with people and with environment, and that they have to think other things, not only profit. I know the mining company exists to make their profits, okay, but we can't accept that these companies kill people. The license to work, the license to mining, the license to extract minerals from the earth, it's not a license to kill people. So I think this case in England, it's a very good beginning for Brazil.
Next week on Dead River, what is the state of the Doce River today?
The advice that I've taken from talking to, you know, all sorts of different varieties of scientists and ecologists and environmental remediation experts is you will never restore, but you can remediate.
Is a river ever truly dead? Dead River is narrated by me, Liz Bonin, and investigated by journalist Cristina Serra and Pulama Kaufman. The podcast is produced by Pulama Kaufman. Stories are meant to be shared. So if, like us, you think this is a powerful and important story, please let your friends and family know about Dead River. And if you're enjoying this series, please leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening.